Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires and supported this month of July by the Justice Brothers. We are looking back, remembering the life of Dave Mirage, one of the most beloved sports car team owners in North America, someone who made an amazing impact on the sport in a very, very brief amount of time. We think of a Roger Penske, who recently celebrated his 50th anniversary in the sport. Then we think of someone like Dave Mirage, who in the 1990s, especially the latter portion of the 1990s, made big waves with Champion Racing, and before long had multiple American Le Mans Series championships to his credit, running the Audi Sport LMP1 program, a Le Mans victory, overall victory as a North American entrant in 2005. Peerless engineers, mechanics, drivers, everybody imaginable that was a part of Dave's Champion Racing team, an extension of his Champion Motors automobile dealerships. And yeah, with Dave's death lost this past Sunday in a boating accident, drowning, just honestly somewhat unfathomable. Boating, yachting had really become his great passion. He had wanted to, at some point, have Champion involved in the America's Cup. And to think that for someone who brought so much to motor racing in such a short amount of time, to then lose his life just with his girlfriend out having a beautiful Saturday evening. Tough to reconcile, which cover here speaking with our friend Alan McNish, multiple-time Le Mans winner, also a longtime member of the Champion Racing family. And then Brad Kettler, also Le Mans winning race engineer and team manager and mechanic, along with all those ALMS championships and such. BK was involved in sports car racing for years before going to work for Dave, but he has always credited Dave and Champion Racing for being, you know, really the launching pad for an amazing, amazing career. So spoke with Alan somewhat briefly. He was on vacation, so we did that through Skype. Then spoke with Brad, who was at home in his rather remote home in southern Indiana. So did our best to get as strong a cell signal as we could and just asked them to share their thoughts about Dave. And Brad retells a story that he shared with me years ago about when things went wrong preparing one of the cars, and went drastically wrong. And why it came to mind was just Mr. Mirage's reaction to it, and just a demonstration of how unique a man he was, and how incredible he was as a boss for so many who are just heartbroken with his death. So thankfully with Alan, thankfully with Brad, just wanted to do a little bit of in memoriam, remembering Dave Mirage here. For those of you who know him, familiar with his career and his accomplishments, maybe they will bring some new stories or context. And for those of you who might be learning about Dave, unfortunately, after his passing, hopefully Alan and Brad really bring him to life for you through their own experiences with him. As I mentioned at the outset, we are supported this month by the Justice Brothers. We'll be right back. This month, the Marshall Pruitt Podcast is being supported by the Justice Brothers, whose line of additives, lubricants, and cleaners are America's brand for quality. The products are also used and proven by the world's top racing teams. So if you're interested in joining the sales and distribution team, Justice Brothers offers products for the automotive, semi-truck, agricultural, and industrial markets. To learn more, please check out their website at justicebrothers.com. So thanks again to Brad, to Alan, for spending some time here while they're honestly just in the middle of grieving. Not an easy subject to speak about, but this definitely adds to my respect for them. So starting with Alan, here we go with remembering the late and great Dave Mirage. Young Mr. McNish, I know that you, among many who were part of Champion Racing's illustrious history and also came to call Dave Mirage a close,
close friend, where you are definitely among many who are grieving this week at the untimely loss. Sounds contrite, but just I would say wholly unexpected loss of Dave. What comes to mind about Dave in terms of his contributions to the sport before we get into who he was as a person?
Well, I think from many points of view, Dave sort of did what a lot of people would want to do, but maybe couldn't quite achieve it. And that was to start a race team, to then have a successful race team, and then to have a complete goal of going to win Le Mans and achieving it. And there's a lot of people that talk about it, but Dave actually was the person to put it into place and to action it and to do it. And from a US perspective, then that's still a major, major factor, because I think the previous United States-based team to win Le Mans, if I'm not mistaken, was Ford. And the Champion are still the last team from the United States to have actually won Le Mans outright. And so in terms of a racing point of view, I think he really started and put a lot of energy back into US racing, as well as actually being so involved in it for many, many years. And we don't just think of the LMS years, I think of the years before that as well.
Yeah.
And when, you know, he was there to some extent as a privateer, but then to actually take privateer status to top international factory status, but all at the same time still doing it with the total and utter passion that it was a sport. And that was one thing I really appreciated about Dave, was he was there because of the passion, and the business was a slightly secondary part to it, because ultimately it wasn't his main business. It was a secondary business to them. And his main business was selling cars, and that he did pretty well as well.
And that is one of the things that strikes me most of all with Dave, is that this is someone who had a passion and desire to do something new, and then achieved the absolute pinnacle in that new arena, different than he's a fifth-generation racer, his father has an empire, and he's stepped into it and is controlling this well-established racing program. I mean, this is someone, you know, coming from the islands, who really, truly made just, I would say, all of his dreams come true through intelligence, hard work, personality, character, a very, very unique person in the sport.
Yeah, but you're right there, because everything that he had, whether it be from Champion Motors' point of view or Champion Racing, or what I think he was going to be doing in the yachting industry as well, in racing there, was very much self-made. And he had clear sights in what he wanted to achieve, and he went out and he achieved them. And that wasn't just by chance, you know, it was definitely by clever positioning and working very hard for it. But at the end of the day, and this is probably the thing that you come back to with Dave, he actually delivered in whatever you said. If you went to him and said about the team, you know, I think we need to improve here, there, or wherever it was, he would sit down and listen. And then you would go back a couple of weeks later and it was done. And in that side of things, he appreciated people that I think were very straightforward, very direct, and had the same sort of passion. But he had a sort of, the thing that probably stood out for me was that, you know, there's two things actually that stood out, Marshall. One of them was he very much had kid gloves on, and he was able to manage people in a very sensitive way, and he gave people opportunities. And I don't just mean the likes of the drivers or Brad, for example, who's a good example, or Keith, who was who's doing our gearboxes and unfortunately passed away a few years ago,
yeah.
Or Bobby, who was number one on our car. But I'm thinking of Jackie, and Jackie was the guy that basically came to all of our races, and he just cleaned up and he tidied up, and he was as part of the team as anybody as far as Dave was concerned. Even though he maybe didn't engineer a car, he didn't work on the cars, but he was part of that team to the same level as everybody else. And Jackie, you see, flourished as soon as Dave came into the truck, because this was the man that respected him and gave him the chance, but also believed in him. And I think that was a sort of good example of how Dave worked with people. He gave them the opportunity because he saw something in them and believed with the right support that they could actually deliver. And the team, to some extent, was that, because when I first drove for them in 99 in Mosport, remember when Thierry had his accident at Le Mans in 99? Well, then afterwards, Amferer and Alwyn asked me to go and finish off the season with champion to replace Thierry. And I turned up at Mosport, and the car was uncompetitive because it was in the wrong category and there was no category for it, and. But in reality, the team was very, very much an amateur team in comparison to what they became. And I would never in my wildest dreams have believed that less than 6 years later they would win Le Mans outright and to be one of the dominant forces, and the dominant force in North American sports car racing. Because that was a team that was just full. It was, a bunch of merry men, weekend warriors to some extent. And those weekend warriors, when I say weekend, they were only working for him at the weekend at the races, because they were working in the dealership or in another shop the rest of the time. And pretty much that core of weekend warriors became the core of Le Mans winners. And I don't think that would have happened under the guidance of anyone else apart from Dave Mirage, because Dave believed in them and he kept giving them the opportunities and he pushed them forward and pushed the team forward and supported them around and about. But ultimately, it was still his guys, and his guys from the start to the end.
Before I ask you to share some racing stories with Champion and with Dave, what did you learn from Dave? What did you take from Dave, and knowing him for as many years as you did? I'm sure that just on a friendship level and whatnot, that he enriched your life, because that seems to be the story that so many people are telling.
Well, I actually learned a lot about the car dealerships, because that is my family background. And basically, how he positioned Champion Motors, how he looked at the way of selling cars, how he wanted and delivered to be number one, not just number one in terms of volume car sales and Porsche worldwide, but in terms of the customer experience and satisfaction, the dealership that he built. That was the thing that stood out for me, because I could see round and about the world other car dealership networks. But, Champion above the door, and it was a Champion without any shadow of a doubt in the way that he did that. In terms of the racing side of things, it was his steely determination, to be honest with you, that sort of rode through from my point of view. And even when you maybe don't, and this is something that actually I sort of think about a little bit more now, and it's obviously more pertinent now. You know, you maybe look at your team and think, well, A, over this side, might be able to deliver on the job a little bit better because he's got more experience. But ultimately, this person here is part of the team and is built up and can do much more than he's able to do or doing at this moment in time, and giving them the chance to be able to do that. And that, with that steely determination as well, it pushed everybody else through. You know, he set out his clear goals, and, you know, there was no question that together they were going to achieve it one way or another. And that's something that I think now, and what I do with Audi and the Formula E program, there's been a few times when I sit back and actually think, well, yeah, but ultimately, you know, the easy choice could be to change a person, but it may not be the right choice. And so you sit back and look at it in a little bit more of a, maybe not necessarily in a historic racing way, actually. And him coming from a completely different background, I would say, would give him different experiences but different way of looking at problems. And, you know, at the end of the day, putting a team together is the same, whether it be a dealership or whether it be a racing team or a yachting or whatever it is. You maybe need slightly different skill sets, but when I say that, Mike Peters was a bloody good car salesman, is a bloody good car salesman, but he still is the best strategy guy I've ever worked with. Now, if you think of a strategy, you have to have a strategy to sell a car. You've got to have all of the answers to the discussions that are coming up from the customer. You've got to be ready and prepared if your competition comes in $100 cheaper on the finance deal. You've got to have all of the answers ready and prepared. And that's exactly in racing. You've got to be predicting what the competition is going to do and have your strategies ready. And Mikey was brilliant. And we won so many races because of Mike Peters. And I don't think it was necessarily just experience from being a from racing strategy. I think it was just general, his working out of strategies. And that came from, in my view, being a part of the car dealership.
Wow. Let's close, Alan, about any memories that might come to mind, the fun stuff from being on track, racing with Champion. And again, this is the entity that was both running under its banner at some points and then also the organization behind Audi Sport in its American Le Mans Series, multiple championship winning efforts. Any thoughts about going racing with Dave that you might share with us?
I remember when, like I say, 99, when it was just a bunch of merry men, if you like, but still with the name Champion, and it was just fun. It was definitely fun. We weren't in a position to be too competitive, but we still tried to do the best job we had. And then if I went on further, 2005, with the program for Le Mans, or our first victory, and for me there was two real key victories. There was the first victory as a factory team, which was at Houston, and it was with the R8, and that was something that was very special because, you know, it was the first time that Dave was actually going to have to answer to Audi, and as opposed to every other time he was answering to himself.
Yeah.
This one, the time he was having to answer to Dr. Ulrich, and we won that race because of Mikey and his strategy. And then the next one that was a big key factor was giving the R8 its final victory at Lime Rock.
Mm.
And all the way through those moments, or whether it be, you know, the races we won and we lost, the man was there. He was standing at the side. I wouldn't necessarily, he was active standing in the middle of everything, but he was there overseeing the operation. And when a word had to be delivered, it was delivered. And when somebody needed to be picked up or congratulated or whatever it may be, he did that. But he was always standing there, and he was always there with just the same sort of lion focus on what he wanted. But like I said, the word that comes back for me is passion, just the passion of it. The thing I also liked is at night we'd sit down and we'd celebrate with a wee Johnny Walker, and he did like a Johnny Walker. And that was the... that was his little thing. He'd just sit at the bar quietly, have a little Johnny Walker, get prepared, mull over the enjoyment of the day, whatever the day had given him, and then on to the next one, the following one. But unfortunately now there will be no more, except in the memories of us all, of Dave Monash.
Mm.
I feel a bit, honestly, I feel a bit confused. A bit hollow in terms of, you know, I wasn't able to go to the anniversary, the 10th anniversary, the day after Sebring, because I was in Santiago. And, you know, the last time I actually was speaking with Dave was when I visited the shop one day and we had lunch. And he was just talking about his yachts and the boat and what he was wanting to do. And he was treating it, and I kept bringing him back to racing. Like, what about coming back to racing? And he was focused so much on this that that's where I find it such a sort of difficult thing to, that he was so focused and believing in it and looking at it in exactly the way that he did with the race team. And that was ultimately the area where he lost his life. And I find that a bit difficult, actually.
Yeah, and I share the same thought in that motor racing is and was immense passion for him. And after the Champion Racing sports car program wound down, his love for the water and yachts and America's Cup and you name it, that really became his
number
big,
one.
Yeah, his big passion. And to, you know, to think of him losing his life just out, you know, with his girlfriend in very, you know, just simple circumstances on the water. Yeah, it doesn't reconcile.
No, it doesn't. It definitely doesn't. But, you know, he certainly did a lot. It's not as if you won't think back and think of the successes or the people's lives that Dave Mirage has changed and changed for the better through the course of his time on Earth. He definitely did that, where he gave a lot of opportunities to a lot of people, more than just the racing people we're immediately thinking of, and set them on their path as well. And in that, I think, you know, there'll be a lot of people that will pay their respects to.
So BK, Dave Mirage's loss, I know, has hit you extraordinarily hard, just as it has many who are members of the Champion Racing family. And I think of you in particular, knowing that you and Dave had a very long relationship. You were, you know, in there and a part of the family quite early. And he is someone who meant so much to you professionally, but I would also maybe say on the personal level as well. Let's just start with your immediate thought and reaction to this terrible news we received, and then let's talk about when you first met him and first became part of his family.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I had had a weekend at home last weekend I was looking forward to, and had Sunday off, and I got a call about 10:30 in the morning, 11 o'clock in the morning. Jerome Freeman, my longtime colleague and friend and so forth there at Champion, and I thought, this seems odd. And he sent me, I couldn't get his call, he sent me a text, he said, please give me a shout. So I called him right away, and I said, this is one of those calls that's not a normal place or time, and he says, yep. He says, it's not. And he told me what happened. And, you know, what I've kind of discovered since that day, today being Tuesday evening, and the normal stuff, the business of customer racing and the work of the BOP and all the other stuff taking place and chugging along, you know, trying to get that kind of sorted so I could spend some time thinking about what really happened there. And the more those around him and those who worked for him, you know, started to communicate with each other back and forth, you know, with Mike Peters and, you know, and Bobby Green and Larry Reynolds and these different people that you start to communicate with as the communication trickles through and so forth. And we all kind of come off the immediate topic to want to share with each other, somehow driven by some force to say how thankful we are. You know, and in the couple of conversations that happened, like even the initial one with Jerome, we went off the immediate topic for just a moment to talk about how my career wouldn't be anywhere without him, and he talked about how his career wouldn't be anywhere without him. And then as I go on and contact my other colleagues, you know, Lewis Malone and other people that work for him and so forth, we all kind of are rushing to say the same thing. And it's amazing how the gratitude amongst this group of people has really been one of the things that, you know, it's been kind of an obvious thing as we start to talk about it. Because what Bobby said today and what Mike said today, I talked with Mike Peters today earlier about the family's wishes and you know, talking about, you know, these things, doing podcasts and interviews and things, if that was okay and so forth. And of course they were supportive of it. But in talking with Mike, you know, about it, we don't really feel the the unfolding of it completely yet. Because I think a lot of us, we had a big reunion in March.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how many of us came, but it was way more than 100. And I think maybe knocking on 150 or maybe even more. It was a lot of people. And it was an amazing event and very much Mr. M style, held on the, you know, the outdoor patio at the Boca Resort there. Just, you know, fantastic setting and everything nice. And it's just an incredible evening. And a lot of amazing communication and so forth went on. And he was so full of life. He was there, you know, engaged in all the people and engaged in all the stories. And Mr. M not necessarily was a historian of sorts. And I mean, even to the point where he wasn't really a fan of old race cars and things, because he was about the future and about the, you know, what's next and what's going to be big and all this other stuff. And I think we left that party with the feeling like he was really in a renaissance of sorts, you know, and that he looked fit, he looked great, he was lively and witty, and we just felt like it was the farthest thing from our mind when most of us left there. We're like, hell, Mr. M's on an upswing here, and the rest of us need to, you know, take our B vitamins and try and keep up, you know? I mean, you know, he was kind of showing us that he was on a, you know, different mission to push the dealership farther and to learn how to sail his boat. And he had his new girlfriend that he was very interested in, and all these things he was doing. And just, I went away from that really happy with, you know, kind of looking upon him as like, this guy's just never going to stop. He's like a dynamo, you know, he's going to reinvent himself and, you know, continue to build teams and do things, the same things he's done, you know, his whole life, and just in a different vein. And, you know, he was very into building the team for the sailboat to do some competition with it and other things. And so, you know, I think for all of us, when we started to communicate with each other about this news, it was really the layers of kind of gratitude and history. It's going to take a long time for us all to kind of sort out, because, you know, for me, it's 20 years, May, right?
Hmm.
And for me personally, you know, Mr. Mirage was very, very important, you know, in a lot of ways, because I started working for him the same month in May of 1998 that my father died. And the first event I went to for him, with him, as part of his team, was the week after my dad died. And obviously, the program I'd been running before Mr. Mirage's with Roar and so forth had stopped, and my dad had died, and all these things had happened in like 60 days. And yes, including starting a relationship with him. But right away, the relationship really had a lot of hook in it, and we were really hooked in together about some of the goals that we wanted to come to and so forth. And that was in May of 98, and not long after that, and we started to discuss, you know, long-term things about ultimately what he wanted to accomplish. And this wasn't me bringing it up, it was him bringing it up, telling me that was kind of his focus and what he was thinking about trying to accomplish. And he had two or three different things, but all of them sort of culminated in putting together a Le Mans effort. And, you know, all of them culminated with establishing Champion as a brand like no other, to be immediately recognized by its color and its shape and its, I don't know, just its brand. And that he was very, you know, focused on doing that. And at that point, really just only had the germ of a race team. He really didn't have a race team, so to speak. He had some people from the dealership who assisted, and a couple of people who kind of put the cars together and so forth, but it wasn't really completely online as you think of Champion being. And And the second race we went to with some fill-ins from the Midwest, some standouts like Kiwi Mark Greg.
Yeah, I love Bobby love me Green, from Greg Martin.
Right, Bobby Green, some of my other, Brian Copans, you know, some of the other standout mechanics, you know, John Wright, assisting and helping me getting this program off the ground, not necessarily to stay there forever, but lending a hand, because we had all been kind of kicked out of the Roar program and we're trying to figure out what we're going to do. And so they pitched in and helped with that with me, and we won the second race we went to. And Mr. M saw that, and he's like, we can do it. We do have the ability. We just need to culminate this and continue to work on it and go ahead. And he gave me a lot of latitude at that point to replace people and change things and so forth, because he believed in what happened. And Marshall, I just get lost in trying to tell the story because you don't know what thread to follow, because they're all good, you know.
Well, one of the things you mentioned to me, I think Sunday, was, I mean, him taking the kind of shot on you of, you know, hey, I'm just a kid from Indiana, and you look at the fact, you know, how many times have you won the 24 Hours of Le Mans, either part of Champion or part of Audi Sport? How many victories, championships, Le Mans wins and such have you amassed? And, you know, you mentioned, like, this truly, you know, we've come to love you and respect you for all you've achieved, but your first point was you can wipe all that stuff off the map if it were not for Dave Mirage.
Yep, 100%. I might have had one, you know, or something like that if I really stayed with it. But, you know, he believed in me very, very early, and he really believed in the planning and in the communication and so forth. And Mr. M, for many respects, now he modernized himself in the last couple of years a little bit, but in many respects before that, he was extremely old school about the way he handled business. And that is not meant at all in a negative way. It's meant all in a positive way.
No, and that's where I think it's really, I think that's such a valuable point, Brad, because instead of saying, hey, I've been successful on the car dealer side and I'm wanting to expand this racing thing and what is it? And most people would be defensive, right? Okay, hey, I already work in the car sales business. I know the unsavory side there, being taken advantage of and whatnot. Many folks coming in from the avenue that Dave did would be very skeptical of the people around him. And just to think that they're, you know, obviously you had experience beforehand. It's not like you started your racing career with him, but he ultimately said, okay, based on your character, this old school way, I have a good feel for you. I'm going to place immense trust in you and so many others. That's not really the normal way these things go in motor racing. So I think that's another aspect of Mr. Mirage, where you go, wow, that was unique.
Yeah, and that was supported, of course, and counseled by the, you know, one of the other most immense characters in my life, by Alvin Springer. Mm. And Dave, you know, as you know, Dave was racing Alvin's cars, and you know, the cars that Alvin represented, and Porsche Motorsport, and so on and so forth. So the relationship there was very important. And Alvin independently invested in me from his side to train me and to bring me farther up so that I could do the job for Dave. So there was cross-pollination there on their side that, you know, gives me a wet eye and honor that they thought enough of me that I could do what they expected. Or at least try to do what they expected. And, opportunity to go forward with it with them as the wind at my back. But you know, Dave did business in a very kind of classical sense, and like the daily meetings at his dealership, I began to embrace, and this was so much of the part of how we got to know each other in a really deeper sense, and that is that between 3 and 4 o'clock every day, or in that era, right in around there, that he would have a 20-minute, 30-minute with Mike Peters, and a 20-minute, 30-minute with me, and potentially 20, 30 minutes with the pair of us. And these were all connectivity meetings, direct question and answer, results expected, updates required, meetings. And they were held every day to make sure he knew what was going on. And, you know, it seems an easy thing to look at and say, yeah, that would be, any good manager would do that. But what he gleaned from it was getting to know his managers, you know, Lewis Malone, me, you know, Mike, Jerome, getting to know us and getting a feel for how, you know, our workload was progressing, you know, was a very important thing for him. And he could read the water if trouble was coming, and if we had something where we had to go to plan B or change or whatever. And he was always so connected in that manner. When you had to come to him with a compromise or with, you know, something that's other than optimum, he didn't slam his fist on the desk and demand it. He accepted it and said that we'll work plan B in the best possible manner we can, and that's what we'll do. And he was a demanding man, but it was mostly that he demanded excellence, you know, in you. That not necessarily, I mean, you could fail, you could try and fail on a project or have something not work out completely that well, but he demanded excellence in the accountability for it and how you approached it, and always wanted the explanation of where the failure happened, and would always accept it. You know, this guy dropped the ball, this guy typed the typo, we ordered 10 instead of 1, we got the comma in the wrong spot, whatever the reason, you know. He would accept it as long as it was known and understood and not destined to happen again. and you know, that's pretty amazing.
It is.
Because the number of things, you know, Mike and I would meet every day about Le Mans, you know, 11 months a year, you know?
Wow.
I mean, there would be very few days in a week at Pompano Beach that we didn't have some level of Le Mans meeting, and probably every 3 to 4 weeks would be a round table with, you know, Kay Wilson, you know, on the phone, and the guys around the table, and everybody with something to contribute. And so we worked at it and we got good at it, but it took us a ton of learning and communication that if any of us had put ourselves on an island, it wouldn't have worked. We all had to be really honest about, you know, what our challenges were and how we were going to deal with them. And, you know, Dave, he was very, very motivated for Le Mans, but he didn't let that shine too bright as like a, he didn't let it be known too much that it was such a treasured thing for him, because he didn't want to freak the people out about it. He's, you know, this is where the world's best go. This is the world stage. This is the top sports car stuff, et cetera, et cetera. You know, he knew all that and put all that out, but he didn't act obsessed with it, but he wanted it bad, and he didn't want his obsession of it or his desire to do it to really make any of us act like we would not normally act, you know. So he went about it with the same kind of quiet push and, you know, assertiveness than he did everything else, but it was really an important thing for him. Really, really important. And we talked about it when he first hired me. He said that his intention was to build a team good enough to go and represent the United States at Le Mans. And it wasn't that we're going to win it. It wasn't like Babe Ruth aiming for the outfield and hitting it out there. It wasn't, but we would go and represent it at the highest level, and hopefully if we had the opportunity and we were ready for it, we could win it. So it was a very practical view, even though it was very lofty. And he never wavered, Marshall. The guy never wavered on what we needed or what we needed to do and how we needed to test for it and how we needed to prepare. He allowed those of us in the team who made those decisions to make them, with the caveat from his side, make them count. Make these decisions count. Make this money count. You know, if we're going to take this action, you know, wring it, wring everything out of it you can. But don't be afraid to test or shake a rig or buy pieces or build spares. Because if you think we're going to need them, then do it. So, you know, just, like, you could go on for hours about that kind of, you know, the preparation, you know, allowing me to backmask and flush paint all of the graphics on all of the noses inside the clear coat so that we could gain that K and a half, 2K, 3K on the front end of the LMP car, you know, at the expense of an extra 100 hours of work for each nose, for each nose going there and going there with nose on each car and four spares for each car. The hours just become cubic, you know, the level of preparation he allowed us to get to. And Andy was my friend. I learned, you know, like I said to you the other day, I mean, he took everything that I ever was involved with him with to a higher level. And by that I don't mean necessarily competition level. I mean spiritual, artistic, historical, you know, human level. He knew the history of so many things, and he was so amazing at being able to draw some kind of a historical parallel from an ancient culture and kind of align it up with the problems we're having right now, you know. And just that level of education, you know, and the wide scope of the world that he knew about was infectious. And, you know, stories of trading diamonds with the diamond brokers in Antwerp for the family, and, you know, doing these things, you know, making, you know, looking and peeking into all these different worlds, you know. Interpretation of a cricket match. I know how a cricket match works because of Mr. M, you know. I do.
Now, he reminds me so much of Angelo Ferro, who was my team owner for many years at Genoa Racing. And so many folks came out of there who've gone on to win championships as drivers and managers and engineers. And Angelo, same exact way. Racing was his passion. You were going to get a great education in the sport, but you were going to become a better man or a better woman, completely independent of motor racing, by being in his presence, because you were going to learn about grappa and what is the good grappa and what is the bad grappa, and you were going to learn about olive harvests in Italy and about this, the time and that, and about the insurance industry, because, if you know, you make a living, you know, selling olives, there's going to be a pit in one of them, and someone's going to bite it and break a tooth, and the next thing you know, they want to take the whole business, and you got to learn, you know. And it's just sitting there, nothing to do with racing, but as a result of racing, where you're going, God, A, this is just a lovely character, but I'm learning so much about life at a young age, or, you know, earlier point in life. And I know that, you know, Mr. Mirage was the same for you and many others, where you go, all right, I'm a better human being for this. The trophies, great, cool, I'll look at them and remember them. But who I am as I walk every day through life has been fundamentally altered and improved because of this person. And that, to me, is why so many people who orbited Champion Racing are heartbroken now. Racing was the communal fire that everyone that brought everyone together, but so much more.
Yeah, and you know his the level of the way he put off his events and the way things he knew about manners and etiquette and British history and all these things. I mean, I had more fun riding in the black cab with him in London because he was like a history lesson, as we, went through around, Speaker's Corner and all this other stuff when we were out going out to Lola's out there. And he's telling me all the, this has been this way since the 1400s and you're allowed to speak out and so on and so forth, but you can't use the Queen's name and you can't do all this. He knew all that stuff and would share it with you sometimes and have these little, kind of bubbly moments. And we, we traveled a lot together. We worked a lot on a lot of different projects and things. And, had a very, he's very human at times. He's Bradsky, I'm tired, I'm really wore out. And, this project's been hard on me and that and so on. And so we became really good friends, about all of these things. And when Champion stopped, he helped me so much. He helped me launch my stuff to assist, Reinhold and his team, and he helped a lot of other people, get their legs underneath them, and in many cases helped them find jobs and did all kinds of stuff for them that way. And years later, 5 years after working for him, or 6 years, or even longer, the calls weren't as frequent, but I would get one about every week or 10 days. And it was the same phone call I got the 11 years I worked for him. And it was, Bradsky, what's going on? He just wanted to know what was going on in the motor racing world, and not the stuff on the internet, but on the, he wanted to know the story. He wanted to be brought up to speed. And I never failed to give him the report, never, because it was such a routine with us that I look forward to giving it to him,
Why don't we do this, Brad? Why don't we close, if you can, sharing some stories about going motor racing with Mr. Mirage, and any fun things that come to mind with him, whether it was a win or when the cartoon anvil fell from the sky. I mean, I know you delighted in his joy when it came time to go racing. You share some any memories you might have, because I think that'll also help folks to appreciate a truly amazing guy.
Well, the morning of Sebring 2005, we had been up very, very early to do a, we'd screwed up the schedule for a dawn photo shoot, and we had to do a race morning. It was very early, and he was nervous about it, didn't like the break in the routine, and so on and so forth. So we went on and did this photo shoot, and as luck would have it, coming back in with the cars and starting to do the warm up with the cars and everything, and we had a starter problem on one of the cars, and it sort of started to send us in a tailspin, that we were going to have to agitate the starter and run the warm up, the recon lap, and then check it again, and if possible, that was a problem. We were going to have about 3 or 4 minutes to change it on the car before we had to go to the grid. And it was a lot of, we were a very together team. We had everything together. We're just trying to decide what to do. And he came to me and he says, Bradsky, just remember, the plane never crashes by one reason alone. And he says, you need to make sure that you open your mind up and think about all the things that are going on here and don't get too focused on this. And let your mechanics, he never told me what to do either, Marshall, never. I mean, he would ask me what I was thinking. He would give suggestions, so on and so forth. But in this occasion, he said, make sure you keep your mind open, keep all your faculties aware. And and so forth, and let your guys that have been trained to do this do this. We got to change this thing, go ahead and change it, and but make sure we don't miss the clothes. I mean, there was a lot of pressure there, and so we decided to change it, and the guys killed it. We had a little stand made for it that we could change it in the pit lane in a couple minutes. We did, got the starter in, it function checked okay, and everything was cool. But on the in the process of doing that, we narrowly missed, you know, the fuel reset process that we always did. And it was his, kind of his voice in the back of my head that made me slow down and look at my previous, you know, how we always did it previously to don't break the routine. We had everything going so well, but being thrown in, having this thing thrown in on us that we didn't expect or see coming, truly had the opportunity to upset the whole thing, and it didn't. And it didn't because of a couple little words he whispered in my ear that I was able to kind of take a breath and share with the guys. Say, guys, I need your eyes and ears and so forth. We got to stay on routine here and make sure we don't miss anything. And it's Sebring. It's a chaotic thing. The car was on the pole.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, the pits are getting ready to close. The red light's getting ready to come on in, you know, 45 seconds, and the tail's not on the car yet and so forth. And deep breath. Prevailed through it, put the car on the grid, and I'm happy to report car one and two had a spirited battle all the way to the end and finished almost 20 laps clear of the rest of the field. So that one, that's the thing. But
let me throw one in here before you get to the other one, because I can't resist, because I swear you told me about this, and I've always wondered how he responded, if I'm remembering correctly. Had something to do in the late 90s, I think, with a Porsche turbo-powered Lola prototype, and something about getting it ready to go to an event and wanting to just run it through the gears and such outside the dealership, and it possibly coming back a little bit waterlogged.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Tell us that story, Brad, because I think it's, as I remember it, Mr. Mirage's reaction was also priceless.
Well, it was, because it was really not, but he took it very matter-of-factly. We made Mikey call him, or Mikey volunteered to call him, or Mikey lost the bet. I can't remember. But the genesis of it was, we had the Lola-powered prototype, and it had the sequential synchronized gearbox in it, which was a very robust, big, heavy thing used in the GT1 Porsche 98. And it was a good gearbox, wasn't a great one, but it was sturdy and so forth. However, it had a particular problem where it had a particle beam welded second gear synchro in it. And when you put a new gear in it, it either held the first time it took load, or it broke the first time it took load. So if it held the first time, it was good forever. If it didn't, chances are you were going back in there and changing it. So we had just done this, and we were getting ready to go to Daytona. We had Mr. Norbert Singer and Herbert Stegmeier, the gurus of the flat six generation back through there, coming to assist us and help us try to get that thing to go as fast as it would. Had a hot tuned engine from either Germany or from Alvin, I can't remember which, where the engine came from, but it was a pretty special kind of warmed up version that we were hoping to get a little bit more out of at the speedway. Anyway, we got the car ready, and we used to drive them around the lake. We lived on the race shop was on had a ring road around the lake that was about a half a mile long. And so we pushed the car outside, and either I drove it and warmed it up, or my dearly departed Big Kahuna, shout out to Big Kahuna, Keith Bransford, our gearbox guy, would drive. And so I was warming it up, sitting at the bottom of the ramp, and my phone rang, and it was a call that I had to take. I don't remember why now. So I stood up out of the cockpit, and I pointed at Keith, and I said, gestured to him, you drive around the lake. He said, okay. So he came and got in it, and it was about done, warmed up, and he took off. While I was still on the phone watching him making his way around the lake here, and he wasn't going fast and so forth, but the intention was to get in a little straight section and boot it hard in second gear and make sure this gear was all right. Well, he did, and it lit up the back tires in such a way that slewed inside. curve, and it jumped the inner berm of the lake circle and did a full gainer into the lake.
Oh, jeez.
And it cleared the bank. It didn't even go down the bank and get mud on the wheels.
Oh.
The asphalt into the water. So Keith gets out of it in shock, obviously.
Swims to shore.
Well, he gets up. He's only about waist deep in the water.
Okay.
So he gets out and gets waist deep in the water. So he gets a hold of the tow hook of the thing. And not to be deterred, and he was a big, stout dude. Not to be deterred, and he got a hold of the tow hook and started dragging this thing toward the bank. Now it's floating a little bit in the back end of it's floating, and so he's got enough mobility that he kind of gets the front wheels almost up out of the water, to try to hold on to it, and he finally has to sit down on his butt, and he's got both hands on the tow hook and his heels dug into the mud, and he's yelling at the top of his lungs, "Get over here, you bastards, and help me hold on to this thing." So we went over there with a four-wheel drive truck and a big ratchet strap, and we couldn't do anything with it. Couldn't get it out of there. So we ended up country boying a rig up off a forklift, including a strap to the four-wheel drive truck, and we kind of wheeled it up out of the lake. And so we drug it back to the race shop, draining all of this manner of, and it was a shallow Florida lake filled with algae and all kinds of stuff, so it smelled really bad. It smelled like low tide, and it was really ugly, and drug it back in there, and Keith just saying, I'm sorry guys, and I said, "Keith, you know what, if it wouldn't have been you, it would have been me, so we're going to end up in the same position here." And so we got it dried out. I called Mike. We started drying it out, and Mike says, Is the engine hurt? And I said, "I don't think so." So I took the intercoolers off the engine, and I looked down in the throttles, and there was no water on top of the throttles. And I said, "I don't think it ingested any water. I don't think it hurt anything." So we drained it out, and I mean, it had gallons of water in each turbocharger and gallons of water in the exhaust and everything. And we drained it all out. We picked it all up in the forklift by the front tow hook and like sort of drained it out like a, you know, and let the water all run out the back end of the tailpipes and so forth. And I said, "Our only chance to get this car going is to get these components dried out. As soon as we can, get this motor hot, get the water out of it, make it out." And about an hour and a half later, we had it running. And it smelled like a shoe on a pot-bellied stove. But it ran okay. And most of its functions actually worked. And it had all TAG electronics in it. So it had all sealed military dash and wiring harness and stuff. It had some real quality stuff. So we took everything out, and the whole race shop was hung like a Chinese laundry with all these different components hanging on wires with fans blowing on them and stuff. And so then Mike called him and told him about it, and his response was, "Well, good, maybe it'll flush the demons out of it," because he wasn't in love with the car.
Yes.
And he said, "Maybe it'll flush the demons out of it." And
what a classic response. What a classic response.
Yep. And we took it to Daytona, and it was one of the best it ever ran, oddly enough. And then we went back. That was before the October or the fall race in Daytona, where we went back and nearly won it with that car. Finished second, got passed on a late yellow by James Weaver on the restart. But that was the best that ever car ran. So in his own way, he said, "Well, you know what?" He kind of took it in stride and said, "Yeah, it might flush the demons out of it. You never know. Our luck may have changed." So, you know, of course he was concerned. And by the way, he was at the U.S. Grand Prix attending the Carrera Cup race at the time when that happened. So he was with all the Porsche big shots and so forth, and had to harbor the news inside that his Porsche race car getting ready for Daytona had just done a full gainer into the lake earlier. That's a classic story, and you know what? When I look back upon it, it was really remarkable, because everybody in the whole shop, nobody thought anything of it. We all jumped on that thing like a duck on a June bug and took it apart and cleaned it up, and we're determined not to let that little bit of bad luck derail us, and it didn't. And the grace with which he accepted the news and so forth, and understanding of the scenario, you can imagine most people would be really pissed. Who did what? Drove my race car into the lake?
Oh, I'm seriously thinking back to maybe one team owner that I worked for who would have fired me and everyone else on the spot. I mean, that's why I think I remember that story, because, well, A, it's crazy, but his response and his reaction was one that was just almost otherworldly, knowing how many folks I've worked for and have gotten to know in the sport, where you go, yeah, that's not how most people would respond. It would be, please pick up your final check, thank you, don't ever call me again.
Yeah, but you know what? He knew the big kahuna. He knew Keith Bransford. Keith was one of the finest mechanics you'd find anywhere, and he knew it was an accident, and he understood the scenario. And by the way, that car had 100% spin rate. There was never a driver that drove it except Andy Wallace that didn't spin it on cold tires.
Wow.
It was diabolical on cold tires. And that caught Keith off guard, and it caught a lot of other pros off guard too. But, you know, Mr. M loved Keith so much and respected his abilities and his dedication that it was seen as a mistake, and an honest mistake that we all truly regretted. But we were just trying to put the best product we could out there. We didn't want to roll off the truck and break that second gear leaving the pit lane and, you know, look stupid that way either. So, you know, we were trying to put out a proper car, and we got the proverbial test drive got us. It's gotten all of us at one point.
Let me ask this to close, Brad, and it's unfortunately a question I've had to ask recently of Dan Gurney and a few others who, whether they were in the sport for decades or maybe not so long, still had a huge impact. What did Mr. Mirage leave behind in terms of a legacy in the either in the sport or with those that he touched as part of the Champion Racing family?
There's no question of his legacy is enormous. I mean, when you look at the number of people who work there that went on to all kinds of successful ventures, either directly or indirectly because of him, you know, his legacy is of the quality and of branding and of, you know, to establish a standard and to be recognized by it. And I think a lot of people that work for him carry that forward. I know I try to as much as I can, and I feel like I fail all the time in comparison to the things he continued to do, but I don't have his resources. But I always, you know, the legacy of the, you know, leaving here, the way you present the car, that the car's always backed in, that the car's always clean, the car always comes off the tailgate complete, you know, you don't refit a dirty wheel, you know, just these little basic tenets of just, they're alive and well, these ideas in all kinds of race paddocks all over this country and overseas as well. And I think it's just the legacy of excellence, you know, that you can do a lot of basic steps to put yourself, to present yourself in an excellent way and give yourself, you know, the best opportunity to be successful. And I mean, I look at my company and I look at the stuff that's happening with Audi in the United States and so forth, and reflecting on this the last couple of years, I don't think any of it would be anywhere near the measure that it is without his thing. The historical cars, without him giving me the opportunity to keep those cars in play and helping me secure the parts and so forth to go ahead and make a business from it, and in a way to keep those cars going, that would not exist without him. That would not. There just isn't the tradition side of it. It just wouldn't be there, because you know, he really supported it and wanted to see it happen. Hmm. So I just, you know, it's so broad, because when I look across all the different avenues and where the people went, you know, across Andy Sattler's program with marketing and branding and the Audi driving experience and all those good people that ended up there. And then you just walk the paddock, you know, with Extreme Speed and, you know, with Core and with all these other people. There's people there that all talk about Champion being the high point in their career. You know, they learned it there. They did it there. And imitation being the highest form of flattery.
And that was my pal Brad Kettler. I know that we could have, as he mentioned, gone on for hours talking about Dave, and I'm sure as more things come to light, maybe we will get a chance to do another episode just sharing more tales. The funeral is set for this Friday, which I know Brad said he was going to drive down for early to be there and see some of the folks at the dealership. Alan mentioned that between himself, Tom Christensen, Dendo Capello, and other friends who raced for Audi Sport in the USA with the Champion Racing team facilitating all of it. He mentioned that unfortunately many of the biggest names tied to Champion Racing have pre-existing commitments that they cannot get out of, but I do know that many of them plan just on their own time to stop by, check in there in Florida, and pay their respects to Dave. So, yeah, hard one. It's one thing when we're talking about a racing legend or hero in his or her 60s, 70s, 80s, at the end of a long life, we're always obviously sad to see them go. But, yeah, harder just to consider with someone like Dave, who, at least for, I think, many folks in the sport, despite his physical age, just felt like someone who was young and vibrant and was just always going to be here. Thanks again to Alan and Brad for taking time here to reflect on Mr. Mirage's life and personal contributions to them, who they are, what they have become, and or what they've learned. And thank you again for tuning in here and listening to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires.